This morning we're going to read a number of parts of the record of Nehemiah and how one man, because he was a man of prayer, he was able to effect a great change with God's people and rebuild the wall in Jerusalem. So open your Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 1. I want to show you a new book I got. You know, I'm a teacher, so I like to show off books, right? And also, you've heard me say before, too, that the English Standard Version, the ESV version, is a version I really think is a very accurate translation. So they've put out a study Bible, and, oh, man, this is really fabulous. So afterwards, you have to come up here and check out the maps, because I was, looking at Nehemiah, of course, since I was going to teach that, and there's this whole picture of what Jerusalem looked like and where was the wall they were building and all kinds of really neat notes. So come up and check it out, okay? And I'm going to be reading the record from the ESV so you can read along with me, and I think you'll be blessed with how simple it is to understand. So Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. Says the words of Nehemiah the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev in the 20th year, as I was in Susa the capital, that Hanani one of my brothers came with me with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. So to just set the background a little bit, this is about 446 BC. It's 90 years after the first captives had come back from being captive in Babylon to Jerusalem. And during that time, Ezra had led them to rebuild the temple, but the walls themselves were still broken down. And if you read the story in Ezra, especially chapter 4, there was a big move of all the neighboring countries and some particular people who were against them rebuilding the walls. And so the work had completely stopped. And that's what Nehemiah's brother, Hanani, comes and tells him all about, how the work is completely stopped. The walls are still all broken down. The gates are burned with fire. There is no way to protect the city. So, verse 4, this is what Nehemiah does. As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. He actually, because of this situation and becoming aware of the extent of the damage and what was happening in Jerusalem, he prayed for 4 months straight. From the time he heard about it till the time we're going to read about what happens. But 4 months. So it's really neat that The first thing that we see here about prayer is that the reason why Nehemiah even got involved with rebuilding the wall at all was because of an initial compassion that just welled up inside of him. And his response was prayer. And as many of you know, my family was here last week, and we took my mom to Palm Springs. And one of the most wonderful things that came out of that visit, you know, as well as, you know, having a nice time, I got to hear all about my nieces and nephews and my brother's families and what was going on in them. And day after day, I started a list of things to pray for. Not that, you know, it was anything like having to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, but it was just so wonderful to get to hear about the need. And I felt that same kind of thing kind of welling up inside of like, well, I'm going to pray for that. I told my brother, I'm going to pray for your new job. I'm going to pray for this. And that's the opportunity that we all have in every situation. See, we may not be building a wall in Jerusalem either, but this whole record applies to our lives too, that It's a lifestyle. Whenever you hear about a need, whenever you hear about something going on in somebody's life, pray. Just start praying. And be amazed at what happens. Okay, so this is the prayer, verse 5, that Nehemiah prayed. And I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants. See, he was praying day and night. He was continuing to pray. He didn't give up. Remember the P's of prayer, persistence is one of them, right? Confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. He's doing very similar. You can take this whole prayer, which is pretty detailed, this first prayer, and you can compare it to the Lord's Prayer and see the parallels, because he starts out with praise, then he goes into confession, and then he asks specifically what to do, and he ends up with praise again. And he's reminding God in verse 8. This is really neat. He says, remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name to dwell there. I read a phrase recently that says, prayer is honest talk with God. And in here, he's reminding God, if you want to keep your finger in Nehemiah, then you can turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 7. This is a promise. He's reminding God in this section that you're a covenant God. You keep your covenant. These are your people, and they have a need. So what? If we return to you, then you should be honoring your promises. It's basically what he's saying. 2 Chronicles 7, verse 14. This is a really, really beautiful promise, I think, in light of this week coming up, too, that we have the election day on Tuesday. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. If my people will seek my face. Remember that verse last week that Barney was reading about seek me, you know, and then your response is, yes, I will seek you. Okay, back to Nehemiah. Verse 10 continues on with the prayer. It says, they are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant. He calls himself a servant. That's also a real huge indication here of Nehemiah's heart. And to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name, and give success to your servant today, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. He's praying this prayer. Remember, he did this day and night for 4 months, but he's saying it like it will happen today. And that's also another indication of how he had built prayer into his lifestyle, that he expected God to answer that today. He didn't answer it. For 4 months, he didn't answer it, but he was expecting that he would answer it today. That word give success, or I think in King James it says prosper. That word is a real key word in here, that he's praying for something to prosper. It means to bring to a successful conclusion or to advance. There's a number of men in the Old Testament that God says they prospered. Hezekiah is one, Joseph is another one, where what they did accomplished an end that God wanted to have come to pass. So we're going to see that word again a little bit later. Now the end of verse 11 says, "Now I was cupbearer to the king." Nehemiah wasn't some great scholar. He wasn't anybody totally special. He was a cupbearer to the king, meaning he was the servant. He was probably from the house of David somehow, because you don't get to be next to the king unless you at least have some status in the community. But the basic thing that it shows when he says, I was a cupbearer, I think it shows that he was trustworthy. Because to be a cupbearer, you got to be privy to all of the things that were going on in the conversations and the business of the kingdom. And the king would not have allowed him to be in that position unless he was a trustworthy servant. So it really shows his heart, doesn't it? It shows that he had the heart of a servant. Okay, chapter 2 now. We'll see what happens. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. Up until this time, he had been praying this, but he had not carried it to the king. He had not approached the king. He had not talked to the king about anything. And the king said to me, verse 2, "Why is your face sad, seeing that you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." Then I was very much afraid. Uh-oh, the king, he noticed something's on my mind. I'm not supposed to be doing this. I'm supposed to be just doing my job. Now what? And the thing was, God was working behind the scenes to get to this place where the king was the one who asked him what's going on. Verse 3, I said to the king, "Okay, well, let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" So he tells him, "I've been concerned about what's going on in Jerusalem because that is my home. It's my family that's going on there." Then the king said to me, "Well, what are you requesting?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. Wasn't that cool? I mean, he didn't just like jump right in and go, "You know what? We need to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem." No, the first thing, even after the king asks him point blank, "What do you want me to do?" He prays. Isn't that wonderful? It's a lifestyle of prayer where you don't jump to immediately, "Okay, we're going to go handle this now." You find out about a need, what you do? Pray. Pray first. Pray even before you do any kind of action of any sort. That's what it's exemplifying here. So verse 5. And I said to the king, so then he tells the king what the situation is with great wisdom. "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." So he's very forthright with what he had wanted and what God had been working in his heart to do. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will you be gone and when will you return?" It wasn't like, "Well, absolutely not. You can't do that. You're my servant." God had already been working in the king's heart to get, so that this is just a natural unfoldment here. "So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time." Verse 7. And I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river." That's what they called Israel, was beyond the river. "That they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. And also a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house that I shall occupy." He was not ashamed of coming boldly to the king. See, when we pray, it reminded me of Hebrews 4:16. You don't have to turn there, but it's Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. See, Nehemiah was not afraid to go to ask the king what was necessary to rebuild the wall. He wasn't just saying, oh, okay, I'll go to Jerusalem and, well, we'll see what happens when we get there. He said, no, you know, I'm not even going to attempt this unless you would be willing to put up the expenses to give me the timber and allow me all the letters of recommendation I need. And he had it all listed out. 1, 2, 3, 4. This is what I need. So part of that 4 months of praying had been God working in his heart to see what was necessary to do if this was going to be accomplished. All right, now verse 9, here we go. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river, and I gave them the king's letters. So far, he goes from Babylon to Jerusalem, and he gets there. Now, my first thought would be that, well, you go right to the leadership and tell them, look, here's the letters. I have permission to do this, right? He didn't do that. Well, we're going to read why the rest of that verse is. Now, the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen. So it was not a small company. He had all these people with him. So he went to Jerusalem first. But verse 10, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So I went to Jerusalem and was there for 3 days. Immediately when he got there, there were these two guys. Isn't that a weird name? Sanballat the Horonite. And Tobiah the Ammonite, they were people who were leaders of the Samaritans. They lived surrounding the area of Jerusalem, but they had come in and kind of taken over a lot of authority in Jerusalem. So people respected them, but they were basically working against God all the time. This group of people had been working against the walls being rebuilt for a long time, and they did not like it at all that somebody was coming in who even was concerned about the welfare of what was going on. So I call them the ites, you know, and there's always ites in our lives. When you start to pray, guess what? The ites are going to come out, and there's going to be different kinds of attacks. And there are actually 5 different kinds of attacks in these records. And we're not going to read the whole story, obviously, but I'm going to show you the places where the attacks are and how Nehemiah immediately prayed to deal with the ites. So this was the first thing that he did when he was in Jerusalem, that he did not give out all his intentions of what he was wanting to do from the get-go. He took 3 days. And he went around Jerusalem. He went to go study the wall out and find out what was going on. He did it quietly. He didn't even talk to the Jewish leaders. And so you jump down to verse 16, and it says, and the officials, the Judean officials, did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, and I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were going to do the work. He didn't even tell the people who were going to do the work right away. He went to scope it out. And that's also, I think, a really great indication of wisdom. There's a verse in Ecclesiastes, I didn't look up where it is, but it's talking about the king, and it says, great is the misery of man upon him if he does not discern both time and judgment. To every purpose there is a judgment. There's always an answer, but we have to discern both the time and the judgment. You can have a right judgment, the wrong time. You can have the right time, but the wrong judgment. So you have to have both in order to have wisdom. And that's what he was seeking here, was what's the wisdom? How do I handle this? What to do? So there's an implication that he was praying during those 3 days too. Okay, now we go on here. Verse 17, Then I said to him, I said to them, so he goes to approach the people. You see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision or be ashamed, right? And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good. Remember, grace being poured out. Good is a similar word for grace. And also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, this is an awesome response of the people. Let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. Just by Nehemiah coming to them and saying, look at what God did. He gave me the wood. He gave me the horsemen. He gave me the permission. It's like carte blanche. Wouldn't you like to help me build the wall? And so they said, sure, we will. We'll do it. Okay, now the attacks come. 19. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and another guy, Geshem the Arab, heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? So the first attack is a mocking. It's like, what do you think you're doing? Who are you? What right do you have to come and do this? And you know, when we have the courage to stand up and pray for some situation, that's the first thing that the adversary will throw at us. Who are you to pray? What right do you have to pray? And you go, okay, look at this, verse 20. Then I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. See that word prosper there? That's that same word. He's confessing, it's not me. I'm nothing. But I have the whole God of heaven behind me. And he will bring it to its accomplished end. That's a cool confession, huh? Okay, chapter 3 is all about the building of the wall. Now we have to go over to 4. Because the second attack starts. Now when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that? The mocking had just gone to a different level where it was mocking, but it was twisted with poisonous words filled with anger. Tobiah, the Ammonite, verse 3, was beside him, and he said, yeah, what are they building? If a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. And I was thinking in our idiomatic way, we'd say, oh, you could knock that wall down with a feather. There's no way they could build. These guys don't know how to build walls. But it was really backed by anger. And the anger directed at them was designed specifically to discourage them. So this is also an attack that comes against us. You start praying, and you're praying, and you're praying, and then you get over the fact that, okay, I'm not good enough to pray, but God will answer my prayer because he's good. And then the next thing is, well, you're not really able to do anything. This is not going to accomplish anything. You don't really have the ability. And so discouragement comes in, right? First thing Nehemiah does is pray. And this is his prayer. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt, their words, on their own heads, and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are the captives. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. So Nehemiah's prayer basically is, God, you handle the opposition. The battle belongs to the Lord. Remember, we've talked about that before. Whenever there's unprovoked attack like that, you can go to God and say, God, you fight the battle. You deal with those guys. I don't need to deal with them, and I don't need to be intimidated by them, because you are the one who has got all the power. So verse 6 says, so we built the wall. They didn't let anything come in the way, even all of these guys making these attacks. And all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. And that phrase is just a really, really wonderful phrase. The word mind there actually literally means heart. They had a heart to work. They really grabbed onto Nehemiah's vision for rebuilding the wall. And they just got to it. They got out their tools. They worked together as families. The way that Nehemiah set up the work was all the families worked together on certain sections of the wall. And they worked really hard. And they worked with a lot of heart. So that phrase is just wonderful about how we built the wall. Okay, now another attack, the third one here. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Adishtites, I told you there are more ites. You get some more ites. Let's see how many more ites we can throw in here. They were gathering their forces, right? They heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, and they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. So they actually were plotting to cause some disaster to happen in the rebuilding of the wall. So the first thing that attack is doing is to cause fear. Ah, fear! They're going to come, they're going to attack. They're going to get, they're going to hurt us. So, 9, guess what Nehemiah does? He prays. Isn't this awesome how he chose his life? And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. And that reminded me of Philippians 4:6, which is such a beautiful verse. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God, which passes all understanding, shall keep or guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. The only way to deal with fear is to put up the guard and let God deal with it. And then the peace is what guards you and keeps away the fear. I read another really interesting statement. It said that threats are opportunities for God's people to stand up and obey. And when you get to this kind of attack, it's really, that you're doing something good. Because if the enemy has to throw all his forces together to try to cause fear, then it's moving forward and things are getting accomplished. And so, why should we be surprised that the ites are there? You just go and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. Set a guard in our minds, set a guard with each other, raise our swords together, right? And say, on guard, and protect each other, to help each other, right? Okay. We are verse 9 there. That was the end of 9, right? And you can read the whole part there about how they actually set up the guard. But look at verse 14. This is Nehemiah's encouragement to the people. And he says, I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. Because God made it sure that they found out where the attack was coming from, who was going to do it, what time it was, and revealed all the secrets of the enemy. And God does that today too. He reveals the secrets of the enemy so that we don't have to be afraid. Okay, verse 16. From that day on, half of my servants worked on construction, and one half held the spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. And the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah who were building on the wall. Those who carried burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held the weapon with the other. And there's a lot more explanation of exactly how they built the wall and who stood there and who worked and who held the spears and all that great stuff. Now, chapter 5 is also an intermission chapter there that talks about another issue that was going on. So we're going to see the fourth and fifth attack just at the beginning of chapter 6. So chapter 6, verse 1. Now when Sanballat and Tobiah, oh gosh, there they are again. They don't give up, right? They're not giving up yet at all here. Now when they were there and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall and that there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set up the doors in the gates. So the wall is getting higher and higher and higher, but the doors are still not there. Here comes the fourth attack. Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, saying, "Come, let us meet together at Hakapharaim in the plain of Ono." But they intended to do me harm. What they were going to do is try to draw him out of the city about 30 miles away so that they could isolate him and get him to compromise. Nehemiah, verse 3, and I sent messengers to them saying, "I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down there. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you?" And they sent to me four times in this way, and I answered them in the same manner. And in the same way, Sanballat for the fifth time sent his servant to me with an open letter in his hand. Now this open letter was visible for everyone to see. So this was an accusation that was going to come against Nehemiah that everybody was going to find out about. In it was written, "It is reported among the nations," and Geshem also says that, "that you and the Jews intend to rebel. That's why you are building the wall. And according to these reports, you wish to be their king. And you've also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem, 'There is a king in Judah, and that's Nehemiah.' And now the king will hear of these reports. So now come and let us take counsel together." So the accusations come fast and furious. Are they true? No. Nehemiah didn't want to be king at all. See? But when we're in doing a work and it's going along and everything's going really good, should we be that surprised that there's accusations coming against? No. So what does Nehemiah do? Pray. Oh, okay, verse 8. Then I sent to him, saying, "No such things as you say have been done, for you are inventing them out of your own mind. For they all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done." They didn't care whether the wall was somewhat built. They were interested in preventing it from any further building. And if they could get the doors on, the gates on, then it would be completely surrounded and they would have protection. So his prayer is a real short prayer right here. It says, "But now, O God, strengthen my hands." Let me keep going. Let me have the strength to keep going. I need strength right now to keep going against this stupid accusation. Last attack, verse 10. Now when I went into the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, son of Mehethabel, who was confined to his home, he said, now this guy was a kind of an acquaintance, right? Not necessarily a friend, but Nehemiah knew him because he had gone to his home. He says to Nehemiah, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. They are going to kill you by night." That sounds weird, doesn't it? So like, let's go to the temple and hide, because they're going to kill you. What this attack is a sort of a friend giving a false prophecy or a false advice. But I said, should such a man as I run away? You think I've been running away this whole time we're building the wall? No. And what man should, such as I could go into the temple and live? It was totally against the law for a civilian person to go into the... They're talking about going into the holy place and not being a priest. Because that would be a safe place to hide, right? Nehemiah was like, no way, I'm not getting close to that. I will not go in. And verse 12, and I understood and saw that God had not sent him, but he had pronounced the prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. So even if our friends come to us, but they're giving us false wisdom or false advice, we still have to go check with the Father and say, right, is that right? Is that right? That doesn't sound right. Right? And he will say, what's the truth? So this is the last attack. And he also says, verse 13, for this purpose he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in this way and sin, and so they could give me a bad name in order to taunt me. It would have destroyed Nehemiah's ministry for him to do that. And then he does a prayer again. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, oh my God, according to these things that they did, and also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. So again, he's saying, God, you take care of it. You're the God of justice. These guys, I don't know what they're doing. I don't know why they're doing it. They're being cruel. They're mean. They're saying false things. Now they've sent me someone that I trusted and giving, you know, making me, wanting to cause me to sin. But I don't know what you should do about it, God, but you take care of it. Isn't that a cool prayer? So this is just awesome. Verse 15 is like the conclusion of the whole thing. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. They rebuilt the entire wall of Jerusalem all the way around, set up the doors, worked together, despite those five different attacks. And, you know, they were crescendoing in the attacks up until the very end, right? And still, they rebuilt the wall because the people had a heart to work. And they listened to Nehemiah because he was a servant and he didn't give up. He led them. He was out there working with them. He was showing them. He was encouraging them. He was showing them how to deal with every single thing all along the way. Verse 16 is sort of a conclusion there then. And when all of our enemies heard of it, all the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem, for they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. It was shining. It was out there. It was like, yeah, God did this. He was the one who helped them rebuild the wall. He was the one who strengthened their hands. See, so no matter what is thrown at us at any specific time, the answer is pray. I wanted to read you just another quote that's a really neat quote about prayer. It says, prayer is the means by which the Lord of all brings his determined purposes to pass. Prayer is the means by which the Lord of all brings his determined purposes to pass. When my people pray, I will heal their land. When my people seek my face, I will be there for them. If you call on me, I will answer. So let's just turn to Psalm 5 and end here. Verse 1. says, "Give ear to my words, O Lord." This is Psalm of David. "Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my meditation. Hearken unto the voice of my cry, my King and my God. For unto thee will I pray." Unto thee will I pray. I'm not going to listen to all those ites. I'm not going to get worried about them. I'm not going to buy into their intimidation, their threats, their false accusation, their twisting of wisdom. I am not going to buy into it. "For unto thee will I pray. My voice shalt thou hear in the morning, O Lord. In the morning will I direct my prayer unto thee, and I will look up." Amen. God bless you.